Evening, everyone. I'd like to give you all a very warm welcome here tonight on what has been a lovely day. We're going to be looking tonight at Esther chapter 8, which I think is probably one of the least looked at chapters of Esther, under the theme of the Great Reversal. So I'm just going to read as an introduction to Matt's address on Esther 8, the Great Reversal, from Esther chapter 8. So that chapter then is an introduction to the Great Reversal. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Joe. Good evening, everyone. Lovely to see you here. Good evening, good evening. Wonderful. Sounds like everyone's equally as enthused and full of energy as I am. Said to Joe, I had a pretty hectic morning at work. Went for a run at lunchtime, which was probably not the cleverest thing to do. Sat down in the afternoon on the deck, made a few more calls and had a cold beer and then went, probably should think about getting to the class, but I did have to drag myself away. It was such a lovely afternoon. But also I think this week's probably been, it's been a little bit uncomfortable for us. If you have a look at some of the things happening, as Joe mentioned in his prayer in Turkey, you know, it's not, it's just not nice to process as a believer that these things can happen. And I had a meeting this afternoon, actually, with a chap who's a Christian, and his comment to me was, well, you know, God's working out his way. Part of it didn't sort of sit right with me. Now, I know God is working in the nations. God has a plan. We all understand that. But I think as time's gone on in my life, I've started to understand my perception of who God was has changed dramatically. That the more I challenge my thinking against the words of Scripture and let Scripture truly speak for itself, the God that I thought I was believing is quite different. And maybe that's been a case for some of you as too, some of you as well. Now, I left my phone there, which I was about to read something out. This is going to make a little bit more sense. Talk amongst yourselves for a moment. I might have even used this in the past, that there is a parable of a farmer. There was once a farmer in ancient China who owned a horse. You're so lucky, his neighbours told him. You have a horse to pull the cart for you. Maybe, the farmer said. One day he didn't latch the gate properly and the horse ran away. Oh no, that's terrible news, his neighbours cried. Such bad luck. Maybe, the farmer said. A few days later, the horse returned, bringing with it 6 wild horses. How fantastic! You're so lucky, said his neighbours. Maybe, said the farmer. The following week, the farmer's son was breaking in one of the wild horses when it threw him onto the ground, breaking his leg. Oh no, said the neighbours. What a disaster! Maybe, said the farmer. The next day, soldiers came and took away all the young men to fight in the army. The farmer's son was left behind because of his broken leg. You're so lucky, said his neighbours. Maybe, the farmer replied. When we interpret a situation as opportunity or disaster, it shapes the way we respond. We can look at the book of Esther. We can look at the events and circumstances in our lives and we can at times question or wonder what the purpose of all this is. And if we challenge it too deeply, we're trying to interpret the long picture that God has in plan for us. And for the first time in preparing, I have done this series in the past before, but for the first time in preparing this time around, it struck me that no one in this story knew what was going to happen next. Now, you're going, duh, of course. Well, you know what? That hadn't struck me. We read the book of Esther. We know the start and the end. We did it as Sunday school kids. But they didn't know it. Esther didn't know what was eventually going to occur. Mordecai didn't know what was going to occur. Haman certainly had a different perception of what was going to occur. So for those of you who came to the first two studies, which were later last year, let's do a quick recap. So the Persian king, Ahasuerus is just a title like Caesar, so it was Xerxes. There's arguments about which of the Xerxes, but you can talk about that amongst yourselves. He had a big party. They got very carried away, and they eventually called his wife, Queen Vashti, to appear. She refused. She was disposed of, and they ran a Miss Universe to find his replacement wife. Now, this is the very much abridged version. The winner of it is Esther, a Jew who doesn't divulge who she is. Her cousin and guardian, again, I always thought Mordecai was her uncle, but he's much older than her, but he's actually her cousin. And her guardian discovers the plot to kill the king while he's sitting at the gates. He overhears it. He passes that on to Esther, and the king's life is saved. Haman is made vice ruler or vice president, has great aspirations, and he becomes angry with Mordecai, who will not show him any respect or honour that he thinks he deserves. So he manoeuvres to get the king to sign an edict which will destroy the Jews. Mordecai brings the matter to Esther and says, I want you to approach the king and advise him of what has occurred. Esther reluctantly begins the process of petition by holding a special banquet for Ahasuerus and Haman. Haman's antagonism with Mordecai grows, leading him to build a gallows on which to hang Mordecai. That's where we kind of left off last time. And if you remember, I tried with a mad flurry to get as much of it done as possible, but we drew a line in the sand and said, come back next week, same bat time, same bat channel. Now, this book could easily have been titled Mordecai, not Esther. What an extraordinary man of loyalty. Chapter 2, verse 7, he brought up his cousin as a young girl. He wasn't legally required to. He did it by choice. He showed loyalty to the king, we just talked about. He put his own life at risk in explaining to the king someone wanted to murder him. And when you dob in a murderer, it's a fair chance if you're found out to be the murderer dobberer, you get murdered as well. He also showed his loyalty to the Jews, which we're going to see shortly. And he has a loyal attitude to God, which again we're going to see. He would not bow to Haman. So while God's name's not mentioned here, his influence on these people is evident. Just as a side note, where would we be as a community if we showed the same loyalty to our brothers and sisters, to God, to our local community, to show stability, consistency, honour and respect like Mordecai? He's also not a person of great status. He doesn't often say anything. He doesn't flaunt his position. He leads by example. And he doesn't ever demand anyone to show him any level of respect. He's the one being honoured in this chapter, in chapter 6, which is where we're going to start before we get to chapter 8. He's the one that's being honoured in chapter 6. But keep in mind, while he's being honoured, he's also facing death. And as I said before in that little earlier, slightly simplistic comment, he didn't know where this was going to end up. But it didn't alter the way he acted. He didn't know the end from the beginning, but it didn't change the approach that he had. So we're going to start with chapter 6. We're going to work our way through to chapter 8 today. And then in the next class of this one, we'll finish up the last couple of chapters of the book. So remember, we left off. Haman's furious. He is intent on destroying Mordecai. He set an edict. He's ready to come in and just destroy this man who will not bow down to him. Have a look on chapter 6, verse 1. On the night, could not the king sleep? And he commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. We all know if we can't sleep, often reading's a wonderful thing to do to doze off, and you can pick certain books that are more likely to nod off than earlier than others. So that it starts with two impatient people. The king, Xerxes, cannot sleep because it's come to his awareness that he's never honoured this man, Mordecai. Have a look at what he says. It says, he found written that Mordecai told of Bigthan and Teresh, these are the two people that wanted to kill the king, the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honour and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, there is nothing done for him. So remember, this is early in the morning. He can't sleep. And there's two men in the court. Two men who can't sleep because of one man, Mordecai. One is desperate to honour. The other wants to have his guts for garters. So he calls out, and just as those taking notes, Psalm 139, verse 16, God keeps a history book of us. Every single one of us. He keeps a history book of every single one of us. He writes it down. Why? Is God forgetful like me? If I don't make my list in the morning, I will definitely forget something that had to be on that list. He writes it down because he loves us. And he writes it down, in my opinion, because one day we will get to see the things that he has written down in this book for us. So verse 4, the king said, who's in the court? Early in the morning. Who's in the court? And perchance calls for an advisor. Now Haman was come to the court in the king's house. So Haman's there early in the morning. No one else is around yet. He came to speak to the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servants said, there's only one person here, it's Haman. The king says, bring him in. Coincidence? Coincidence? Interestingly, John 20 verse 1 and in Luke and in Mark, at the rising of the sun, the women came to the tomb while it was dark. Who would reveal him? Who will unveil this man that had been fasting 3 days and 3 nights? We'll come more to that in due course. And just look at how this plays out. And look at how the hand of providence works in this story. Because at the moment, we have a flustered king and Haman hell-bent on destroying Mordecai. And he's in a fitful rage and he's anxious and he's fast-moving. And God puts the brakes on and slows the whole thing down. But before I read the next bit, just have a look at this. How differently would this have played out if Haman had had one moment to speak? God had this whole thing in control. They were like puppets on a string and he allowed it to take place exactly as he wanted it to. And the king's servant said, behold, in verse 5, Haman stands in the court. The king said, let him come in. So Haman came in. The king said to him, so Haman's come and walk in. He doesn't say to him, what are you doing here so early? If Haman had said anything at this point, he would have said, well, actually, king, I need to talk to you about something. The whole thing would have gone completely off the rails. So the first thing he says is, what should be done to the man who the king delighteth to honour? Now Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to honour to do more than myself? And it just played right into his hands because Haman was a man filled with pride. Look how quickly that changes. Haman's storming through the palace. Where's the king? I need to speak. I've built this gallows. I'm going to kill this guy. Oh, who does the king delight? Oh, well, mood change. It's got to be me. Have a look at his answer. He didn't want money. He obviously was a very, very wealthy man. Have a look at what he's asking for. Haman answered for the man whom the Lord delighteth in verse 7, I want your royal apparel, which you wear, the horse that you rideth upon, the crown royal which is on your head, and let the apparel and the horse be delivered in his hand to one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man. So get a noble prince to dress him. So don't get a servant, don't get a chamberlain, get a noble prince to dress this man, that they may array the man whom the king delights to honour, and bring him on your horse through the streets of the city, and proclaim before him, this shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honour. And the king said to Haman, make haste, take the apparel, the horse. Now, just wait a moment. What has he just asked for? What do you think he's trying to be? Sorry?
King.
He stood there blatantly in the face of the king and said, I will be you for the day. That's treason. What happens to treason? Gone. He was so full of pride. He was so full of himself. That was the only thing he could think of. And we thought that the mood change went really well before. How's this mood change? So he can picture it in his head. He's like, oh my goodness, wait till everyone sees this. This is going to be amazing. Everyone's going to see me on this. This is going to be the best thing ever. And then he says, oh, by the way, go and get Mordecai the Jew, the one that sits at the king's gate, the one that you walk past every day and the one that you hate. That's how he hears it in his head. Go and get him. Let nothing fail of all that you just asked for. Now, I'm going to embarrass Darcy for a minute, but my parents and in-laws can vouch for this, that Darcy had this ability as a child that if we said no to something, his entire body would just go, like that's like hands on the floor, sorry.
Hangdog
look. And he would just, out of the...
I can't imagine that. Darcy, get up and
get
us a dinner.
Yeah.
Real snakes and leathers, isn't it?
Oh, this is exactly right. So he's just gone from, in his mind, the highest of heights to the lowest of lows. I cannot believe how this has swung around. Not only is it not me, but he said, get the most noble prince, you, my vice president, there's no one below you, above you apart from me, so you go and get my clothes. You go and dress the man, put the clothes on him. You go and collect the horse. You go and walk through those streets.
It's also kind of amazing how quickly the king just agrees to this. Like, Haman just says this idea of the king to be like, yeah, go quickly, take all this stuff you said. It's like, you'd expect the king to be like, oh, you know, maybe let's tone this down a bit. Let's, you know, let's meet some sort of middle ground, barter, break it down. But the king's just like, no, sounds good.
Yeah.
He may have felt differently about it if he was given to Haman, but because he was a natural man, he was modest, perhaps that made him more comfortable
about it. Well, see, you've been reading my notes. So I actually had a little note here that says Mordecai would have died rather than glorify Haman. He wouldn't bow to Haman. He wouldn't bow to Haman because that was against his philosophy in relationship to God. So something as simple as bowing to Haman, Mordecai would have risked his life to say, I cannot parade through the street glorifying another man. I'm sorry. You'll just have to take my life. Haman had no moral compass at all. He was willing to do anything for his glories, and he was willing to do anything if, you know, his life was at risk. You can argue that point amongst yourselves, but I, or with me later on if you like to.
But he didn't seek for glory.
He didn't. He didn't seek for glory, and yet he had a really strong stance on glorifying other people. He would not bow down to another man or woman, no one, because there's only one person he bowed down to, and that's God. Isn't it interesting? Because then he goes through the city and off they went. So verse 11, I like how scriptures have just put the brakes on all this and they've gone, right. So look at the repetition, because he's asked him, what do you want to do? And get the, so it doesn't just say, get your royal clothes, horse, and walk through the street. It says, you know, get the, verse 8 was the royal apparel which the king wears, the horse which the king rides, the crown which is on the king's head. Like, it's extremely detailed. And then he says, go and do all the things that you've said. So in verse 11, Haman then took Haman the apparel and the horse and arrayed Mordecai. They've broken it right down and said, this is just would have been tearing him to pieces. Imagine the gritted teeth. He's like, move your shoulders, just sit still so I can button, like we do with the kids in the morning. Not Darcy, he dresses himself now. And it's, well, yeah, you can tell, you know, the socks and sandals. So he brought him on horseback through the street in the city, past all of his friends, past the gate himself where he would refuse, where Mordecai refused to bow down to him. So he's going past the gate, the business district where Mordecai was involved and well-regarded and well-esteemed. Now he's on the king's horse. From a distance, every single person would have thought this was the king. And as it goes closer, their jaws would have just... Not only that, then they're going double take. Wait a minute. The vice president is taking Mordecai, the Jew, on the king's horse? What is going on? Just pause for a minute. And again, I'm going to reiterate this. Oh, sorry, there's a hand up. Yes, Trevor.
Man, I find it quite interesting because all of a sudden the king says the Jew. So somewhere along the line, Mordecai has declared his Jewishness. He's come out.
Yep.
He said who he is. And I mean, that might have been picked up in the Chronicles. The king might not have even been aware. Prior to this. But I find it interesting as soon as I see that the king says the Jew.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the lines this information has come out. Well, I wonder if, you know, prior to all of this he'd been aware.
Yeah.
A lot of this has been going on underneath.
That's right.
His feet.
And certainly his opinion of the Jews was one of respect, because when you dig through the entire book, you find he understands the value of the Jews to his economy, that his kingdom would fail in the absence of the Jews.
Because when Haman comes up, he doesn't tell the king what race it is.
That's correct. That's right. Yeah. But it is really interesting that he specifically labels him the Jew at that point. When I talked before about how important it is to pause and examine the characters in this, I keep saying story, it's not a story, narrative. It's an event. It's circumstances that took place. That when you pause, have a look at this man, Mordecai, because this is who we're going to spend a fair bit of time talking about tonight. How did he respond? Do you know, as a parent, it's difficult to sometimes not say, I told you so, isn't it? And you say to your kids, don't, please, don't do that. Don't. I know, if you're going to go, no, don't do it. And you turn around, you walk away, and then bang, oh, whatever else. You're like, I just literally just told you, don't do that.
We can attest to that.
Yeah, I know. My sisters were terrible. But how humble of Mordecai right now to not lean forward on that horse and say, "Hey, Haman, how are these apples, mate? Enjoying this?" That's not in his character, is it? He's silent, absolutely silent, absolutely silent. So what has dawned on me is that Mordecai let God work through him. Something I have found difficult in my life, of letting God work with me, through me, to achieve something. Because I have a strong, stubborn streak where I think I've got it right and I know the right way to do it and I've got this under control. And I'll make this happen the way I want to make it happen. And I'm probably not the only one.
After this happened, you know, I've been elevated by the king. I may as well go to the palace and say hello. You know, I've just been wearing his clothes and swords. Like, what? You know, why not? But Haman's thought goes back to where he was before.
100% right.
Sorry, yeah, Mordecai goes back to where he was before. It doesn't, you know, doesn't feel like it's changed or elevated his station. It's just like, well, that was my morning, I guess. Now back to what I was doing after.
Exactly right. So have a look at his character through here. Is he wasn't an inactive man. Yes, he had 3 days of mourning by the gate where he laid on the ground and did nothing and he mourned and he cried and he had sackcloth and ashes. But that was a demonstration. Being at the city gates mean he was active in business. He was calm. And when the edict came out, he acted straight away. He said, "I need to speak to Esther." He prayed, he fasted, he got word to Esther. Faith isn't inactivity. It's what John was talking about on Sunday, wasn't it? It's remarkable in looking at my notes here how many times some of the things that John spoke about in his exhort on Sunday have come up in this. Faith isn't ignorance or apathy, it's action. Now, I gave this example to my Sunday school class many, many years ago. One of them, his dad had skin cancer in his leg and he went to the doctor and they got cut it out and had an operation. They sewed it all up and off they went. And I said to him, "Well, why did he go and do that?" "Oh, because the doctor told him to." So he believed the doctor, yes. And he believed if he didn't do anything about it, it would kill him, yes. That's faith in a really simplistic, childlike fashion. If you believe God has said, if you don't live a life like this, and if you don't honour me and worship me and change your life to look like my son Jesus, then you're going to die. So I've given you an opportunity here and I want you to act. So because you believe it, you do something about it. That was the simplistic Sunday school version of trying to explain to people that if you believe something, if you truly, because this was talking to teenage boys who were saying, "Oh, well, you know, I do believe in God. I believe the Bible. I'm just not quite sure if I'm ready to get baptized. I'm still kind of living my life." And I said, "Well, I challenge you, you don't believe it then." Now, that was an uncomfortable conversation. But if you can look someone in the eye and say, "I believe in God. I believe Jesus is coming back. And I believe this is God's word," do something. Yeah, do something about it. Couple of great quotes about pride. Daniel 4, verse 37, God is able to abase the proud. And Isaiah 2, verse 11 and 12, the proud will be brought low. So verse 12, as Sebastian said, what happened after this display? How did the two distinctly different men react? Mordecai didn't go into the palace and say, "Well, I've got the king's clothes, got the horse, got the crown, move aside everyone, I'm important, I don't know where I'm supposed to be, but, you know, clearly, I'm not sitting at the gate anymore." He went straight back to the gate. He didn't hesitate, didn't linger, didn't loiter, didn't answer any questions with the press, just went on. Have a listen to this quote. "A proud, ambitious man would have said to himself, 'No more of the king's gate for me. I shall direct my steps now to the king's palace and hold myself ready for honour, office, emolument,' whichever word that means, 'which surely must now be at hand. Mordecai seems to have said within himself, if these things are designed for me in God's good providence, they will find me. But they must seek me, for I shall not seek them. Those who confer them know my address, Mordecai at the king's gate, and will still find me there. Isn't that a beautiful summary of this man? As for Haman, he ran home, his eyes burning with rage and fear, angry tears, and he covered his head in mourning, put a paper bag over his head. Haman hastened to his house mourning and having his head covered.
You think he was embarrassed?
I think he was absolutely humiliated. Absolutely. So I don't see it necessarily as I know I'm a dead man walking, because the way the rest of the next few verses play out, he's not of the understanding that he is. I think he's absolutely humiliated. Verse 13, he goes home to his darling wife, and his darling wife, who just moments ago had said to him, this is all yours, the king's calling you, go to the palace, this is wonderful, you're the best thing ever, him and his friends. Have a look in verse 13. Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends, everything that had befallen him. Then the wise men said, and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, if Mordecai by the seed be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but thou shalt surely fall. You're dead, mate. What an encouraging stalwart of a wife she was. Sorry, darling. And while they were yet talking, there's some amazing parts of scripture there. I'm going to take a little bit of a tangent, though. Numbers 24, verse 3 to 7. So let's turn this up because I'll get you guys to read it out. Numbers 24. Yeah, I'm just mindful of time as well. Who's got Numbers 24 open? Yep, do you want to read verses 3 to 7 for us? Oh, we're going along the road, yep.
Then he uttered his oracle, the oracle of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eyes were open, the oracle of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, pulling down of his eyes and cover.
Beloved in the tents of Jacob, here in the camping city of Israel.
Like palm groves that stretch afar, like gardens beside a river, like aloes that the Lord has planted, like cedar trees beside the waters.
He shall pour water from his buckets, and his seed shall be many waters. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted.
Do you think these guys knew this prophecy about the seed? Have a look, that they didn't say Mordecai. If Mordecai, not a Jew, be of the seed of the Jews. The wise men, particularly, I imagine, maybe the wife, but the wise men have used a very interesting word here. If we keep reading across the front here, verse 17 to 20 of Numbers 24.
I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Shechem.
And the Edom shall be a possession, Seir also, his enemies, shall be a possession, while Israel does it valiantly.
A ruler will be established from Jacob, he will destroy the remains of the city.
So how's that for a prophecy of the growth of the seed of Jacob, the Jews, the children of Israel, and overtaking these kings? These wise men have actually utilized words and phrases directly from Numbers and saying, if this guy's from the seed of the Jews, nothing you can do can change the course of history. This is how it's playing out. And it actually says also in Isaiah 61, verse 9. Their descendants shall be known among the Gentiles and their offspring among the people. All who see them shall acknowledge them, that they are the prosperity whom the Lord has blessed. This is the seed of Israel. These words here are the first time used in this story so far. The seed. What an extraordinary use of words here. And don't worry, providence hasn't finished yet. Because it says in verse 14, while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted. So while he'd only just gotten home, he's walked in the door, burst open the door, gathered everyone together and said, "You're not going to believe it." They would have already known. "You're not going to believe what's happened." And they've said, "You're a dead man walking." And as they were saying it, the doors burst open. In come the king's chamberlains. Chamberlains. First time so far that the king has sent more than one. Because up until now, he sends a chamberlain, a single person, to go and do this. This time, no way. The wheels are turning and it must take place. He's sent more than one and they've all come and said, make haste. Bring Haman to the banquet that Esther has prepared. And chapter 7 starts off looking...
Such an incredible contrast here in chapter 6 from the end of chapter 5. It's like the same people in the same place. Like it's Haman, his wife, his friends. Same sort of little meeting, but the vibe, the atmosphere in the room is completely different.
Do you know what? You guys can actually do this for me because this is my next bit of my nose. Between Seb and Kat, we could just hand it over. This is fantastic. You're right, three people, once again, totally different vibe. What's the sentiment among these people? The king has just rewarded someone who he believed was due reward. He's feeling pleased with himself. He's feeling good that he has done something right. He has performed some justice. Haman is beside himself. Imagine the tension going in the room at the moment with this man. And Esther is calm. Why do you reckon Esther's calm? What's just happened that's made Esther calm?
Mordecai.
Yep. What about Mordecai? Why do you think she's now calm? So there's three different answers there.
She saw God intervene.
She saw God intervene, yep.
His life is safe.
Yep. Mordecai's life safe. The king's shown his hand, hasn't he?
He's on her side.
He's on her side. So while he doesn't know the full story, she can understand where his loyalty lies. So the tension in her has left the room. So they walk in, heavy feet, I imagine, from Haman. Verse 2, the king said unto Esther on the second day of the banquet of wine, interestingly, she was still fasting, so she wasn't drinking. But in this banquet of wine, he says, "What's your petition, Queen Esther? And it will be granted. And what's your request? And it shall be performed. Even if you want half the kingdom." It gives her a little bit of confidence, doesn't it? Half the kingdom. And have a listen to this spectacular response from Esther. Her graciousness here. And Esther, in verse 3, the queen answered and said, "If I found favour in your sight, O king, and if it pleased the king." She hasn't made any assumption at all, still being honourable and respectful. She knows that he is still a king, so she shows him respect. She says, "If I found favour in your sight, let my life be given to me at my petition and my people at my request." So that's the petition, the request. He just said, "What's your petition? What's your request?" But it was one answer. Now, I wanted to just stop for a moment. What a wonderful reminder, brothers and sisters, and young people, that the true essence of discipleship is to desperately seek the life of your brothers and sisters. And that's something I know Sally and I have found. Coming here, there is a real beautiful sentiment of care and nurture for one another. That everyone physically shows that they want everyone else to be with them in the kingdom day. That's how we feel anyway. And what a beautiful way. If we're all striving just to make it to the kingdom, we're going to fail because we're just fairly useless, aren't we? But if I knew every one of you had my back and you're there to help me reach the kingdom, and every opportunity I got to help one of you to be more like Jesus, I would. How much better would our lives be? And this is exactly what Esther's just done. It's my life, but wait, most importantly, my people.
Can I just point out something? In chapter 1, the king makes a decree that you've all got to come to this great feast and make merry. But he also says, according to your will, according to your custom, if you choose not to drink, then that's fine. You don't actually have to drink.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it seems at this point the king has been drinking. Okay, so, of course, events take place and he's probably been under the influence. But he comes to Esther's banquet, and she's sober.
Mm.
And she hasn't partaken of it. And it's interesting because both these two characters come to Esther. Because that's really odd.
Mm.
Because when you have a look at the customs of the East, that just really shouldn't happen.
Yeah.
And then by the same token, if you take it back to the Lord Jesus Christ's time, he didn't take it to sock. He didn't deaden the pain by taking the sock, by taking the drink. He tasted it and that I'm not having that. And it seems interesting that this whole thing's played out, that I'm wondering, you know, we go back and talk about how perhaps the king may have known or may not have known, and Mordecai, the Jew, and suddenly that's probably come out of a drunken torpor after the events that have taken place. I'm just wondering, you know, the Jewish people were running by this, well, we won't partake of that, a bit like Daniel.
Mm.
Just a point.
Yeah. So have a look as we continue on then to her continuation of her request. Verse 4. She uses some unusual language at first glance. She says, "For we are sold, I and my people," that's what you do with slaves, yeah, "to be destroyed." We don't sell someone to be destroyed. You don't buy a slave to take home and cut their head off. It's not the way it works. And not only that, she says, "to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish." Well, I think you could have said one of them. She was being emphatic. There is no outcome here apart from death for me, I, and my people. "But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy would not countervail the king's damage." What's she talking about here? What's the sold bit? Does anyone remember what happened a little while earlier, a couple of chapters earlier, if you're familiar with the book? What did Haman promise? When he came to the king with an edict, does anyone know what he promised him? Somewhat, he did. He actually promised him, he said, "I'm going to get rid of some people, and as a result, I promise you, I will pay you a certain amount of money for the impact it would have had." Sorry?
10,000 talents.
10,000 talents. Which it actually says he was actually going to take it from them anyway and keep whatever else, the spoil he got from those people, and then just pay the 10,000 talents out of what he's ripped off them. So here she is using his language, and by this time Haman's looking for a hole in the ground to swallow him up. And the king explodes. Who is he? Where is he that is going to do this? Who is he? Where is he? Bring him to me now. And Esther said, the adversary, the devil is the word here. The false accuser, the adversary, the enemy is this wicked Haman. I think just for a moment she lets her veil of calm go when she calls him the wicked Haman. Yeah, the same person that said, oh, give me your robes and, you know, take me around on your horse. That kind of guy. It's wonderful how this plays out, isn't it? And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. He was so angry. This was still his vice president, though. But he's so angry, he just walks out of the room, storms out of the room, goes out into the garden. That's where I go when I'm angry as well. Go and start mowing something, or goes out into the garden. It says, just a little note. If you are taking him, Haman was afraid. The word afraid means petrified, as in he was turned to rock. He couldn't move. Couldn't move. And the king stormed out, and Haman stood up to make request of his life to Esther the queen. For he says there was evil determined against him. He's just, you know, the pennies dropped. And the king returned to the palace garden, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. Again, my Sunday school days, I was told that, oh, therefore, you know, Haman's taken the opportunity to go and try and rape the queen. Like, that would make no logical sense. It says, you know, he's climbed upon her on her bed. What it actually means, because it would be completely, this is a man petrified dying. Why on earth is he going to either attack the queen or try and seduce her? It makes no sense. All he's doing is saying, he's trying to, effectively Xerxes comes in and says, how dare you force my queen to show mercy and try and change my mind? That's what he's saying. How dare you force your point upon the queen? You should say nothing. And Haman was taken out. Now, if you're a bit queasy, if you're a bit queasy, don't look up.
No, you're all going to look up.
So I did a little bit of hunting around. So the gallows weren't actually gallows. They were just a really long spike with a pointy bit at the top, and they would impale you from the bit between your legs straight up until it came out the top of your head.
Satay stick.
Exactly, Kat. Yep. Yeah. Barbecue. So it's pretty gruesome. So they didn't hang him around on a rope and hang him off a tree. It wasn't gallows like that. They would just sharpen a big, really, really tall. And this one here, from memory, was about, it was either 15 or 20 metres tall. I have to go back through my notes from last year. Tall. 50 cubits. So whatever that is in metres. I know I did. Sorry?
25.
Had anyone ever jumped off the 10-metre diving board at the Aquatic Centre? I've done the 7.5, and that frightened the living life out of me. 25 metres is... So this was the gallows that Haman made for Mordecai. He wanted every person in the entire palace region to see this man skewered on top of this thing. And it was him who ended up on this. In this instance, that's not a picture of Mordecai, but this is an actual carving from that era. And so now we come, as Joe said, to a slightly interesting chapter in chapter 8, which kind of feels like the story's finished. You know, if this was a Disney movie, you kind of draw a line in the sand there and go, da-da-da-da, she ends up with the king, the bad guy gets scalloped, and everyone skewered, even better. And everyone goes home happy, except for the skewered fellow. He's less happy. And Zeresh is happy because she said, you're a dead man walking, so don't worry about it. But this is where we get to the theme, the great reversal. So chapter 8 says, on the day, verse 1, did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen? And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told him what was done. Gave it all. She subsequently gave it all to Mordecai. So the king gave Esther Haman's house and everything he had. Remember, money wasn't an issue for him. He wasn't interested in money when he was offered a gift from the king. Verse 2, the king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman. So before he stuck him up on the pole, he said, I'll have that ring back, thanks very much. Because remember, he had given the king's ring to Haman to seal the edict in the previous chapters. So he gave it, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So she's handed the house over to him. And Esther spoke again before the king and fell down at his feet and besought him with tears. Why is she besought? Because she just saved him, haven't they? Have a look what she says. She goes, to put away the mischief, it's probably a funny word to use, the bad deeds of Haman the Agagite, Agag we just read about before, how the seed of the Jews will take over the Agag. How's that for a prophecy? Haman the Agagite, that he has devised against the Jews. And a king again holds out his scepter and she arises and comes before him. What's the problem? Verse 5, he says, if it please the king, if I found favour in his sight, and kings seem right, the things seem right in the king's eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which wrote to destroy the Jews which are in the king's province. How can I continue on and see my people destroyed? Verse 6. Problem he's got is you can't reverse the king's edict. Once it's sealed, no matter the intent of it, it's sealed. What does he do? Verse 7. The king said to Esther the queen, and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I've given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged upon the gallows because they laid the hand upon the Jews. So here's a new edict. Write ye also for the Jews as it liketh you in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring, for the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse. That's what he said the first time too. The king's scribes called out in time the third month, which is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day thereof, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded unto the Jews, blah, 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 blah. On he goes, and he effectively gets down to partway through there. It says, every people after their language, and to the Jews according to their writings, and according to their language, and he wrote in the king Ahasuerus' name and sealed it and sent it out. Wherein the king granted, in verse 11, the king granted the Jews which were in every city to gather themselves together, this is the essence of his edict, and stand for their life to destroy, slay, and cause to perish all the power of the people and province that would assault them, the little ones and the women, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. On one day, in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is in the month Adar. What does that mean? It means, he said, I can't reverse my edict. What I'm going to do is say, anyone's got a problem with the Jews? On this day, go for it. Hey, Jews, on this day, you can kill whoever you like. That's the watered-down version of it. So he's created a new edict that says, on that one day, I will allow you to defend yourself. Verse 13, the copy of the writing of a commandment to be given to every province which was published unto all the people and the Jews will be ready against that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. So the posts that rode upon mules and camels went out, being hastened and pressed by the king's commandment. There's words of frantic nature now. Get this out. Every province. Do you see the amount of times? And I skipped through half of that. It's like every Jew, every province, every ruler, everyone in the land, everyone needs to know this is going to happen on this day. So the Jews see it, but so does everyone else. Everyone else picks up this letter and says, wait, so the Jews are allowed to kill me on that day if I try to attack them? Oh, okay, this is interesting. So everyone in the land knew where the king stood. And Mordecai went out, verse 15, from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white with a great crown of gold, with a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city rejoiced and was glad. Why are they rejoicing? But they haven't been saved yet, have they? Sorry? Haman was a mongrel. Yep. So he's taken care of. But remember, on this day, the edict still stood that the Jews were to be killed. Yeah.
They likely didn't kill
him. Mm-hmm.
It's just my thoughts. I'd imagine if that went out, then why would Mordecai write that anyway? But maybe if they didn't kill anyone, then the people would see them in a different light, because it was Haman, he definitely...
Yeah. Well, have a look in verse 17. On every province and every city, whithersoever, we see it again, wherever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness and a feast and a good day. We're going to cover that in the next class in more detail. And many of the people of the land became Jews because of fear for the Jews.
They knew the king was now with them.
Yeah.
That's it, yes. Ben, what are you going to say?
They definitely did kill people, Esther 9 verse 5. But I think the thing is that's interesting about the king's edict is it doesn't say you can just defend yourself against attack. It actually says you can kill people that might kill you.
That's right.
So in other words, there's been nearly a month, and I'm sure there's been, let's call them quasi-Hamans, who have been walking down the street of Jewish houses going, wait till the 14th.
Mm.
So it's kind of like the people that had an in for the Jews have now revealed themselves, and so now they've actually got an opportunity to do away with them, the people that were going to the inn and have been sort of glorying in that fact.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
I think the key to this is in the language. The Jews had light, gladness, joy, and honour. When?
As soon as the edict went out.
This is part of Isaiah's restoration promises. And they didn't, did they? Because guess what? They're a bit like the people coming out of Egypt. They really wanted to stay there.
Yeah.
So I see that language of joy and happiness as being prophetic.
Yeah. And I guess where I'm going is, how does that relate to us today? Do we feel, I feel, joy and light and gladness and happiness because I've been saved? There's an edict that's not warranted by my behaviour. It's warranted by my king's behaviour. And so I have joy and happiness and gladness. I am thankful. I'm not immortal, but I feel that I have been saved by the king's edict. And that's the sentiment that the Jews had, is they read this edict and went, we've been saved by the king, regardless of what happened next. And again, just I'll come to you in a second, Ben, is think what John was just saying last week on Sunday, when he's talking about faith and action. Did the Jews go, I'm saved, I'm just going to sit down now and this is all taken care of? When we've been given an edict saying you're saved, do we just say, well, just keep going and do what I'm like, live my life? Because, when Jesus comes, I've been saved, yeah? that requires action, it requires activity, it requires us to fight for what is ours, fight for what's God's. This is the behaviour of the nation at this time. Ben.
To answer your question, how does it relate to us? 1 Peter 2, verse 12 is probably the answer.
Do you want to read it for us? Or?
Yeah, sure. Keep your conduct or way of life among the Gentiles honourable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, so people might now think that we're fundamentalists and against gay marriage or whatever, that they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. So that when Christ comes, people will go, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Because of the way we live and the lives that we espouse.
And the example of Mordecai throughout this, of his humility on, and of his determination and his hard work and his honour and his respect and his loyalty, when they see that, they understand.
There's one thing we have to remember, though, at the end of the actual book of Esther. In a sense, even though the great reversal took place within the kingdom of Ahasuerus, it's still assimilation. So the outcome was actually, instead of the Jews being expelled as they were, in a sense, got themselves out of Egypt,
yeah,
the Jews were not expelled out of the Assyrian Empire. In fact, actually, the success of Esther and Mordecai integrated them further into the empire.
Mm.
And in a sense, that is the key to the last exodus of the Jews from the world, is that the Jews, through the acceptance in the world empire, we're in a moment, it is hard for them to leave that world empire. And they will be drawn from the four corners of the earth by God Himself out of need, because they again once again will be reviled as Jews, interestingly.
Mm.
And the interesting thing about the empire of Ahasuerus is that the Jews, when you say the word Jew in Persia, they are king. Because they left Persia with Abraham, and they returned humbled to Persia by the exploits of the Babylonians and Assyrians.
Mm.
And they were basically king, whereas in Egypt they were foreigners, strangers, and they literally were treated as slaves. Whereas in this empire, they were treated as quasi-equals. The problem with Haman was that he was an Agagite.
Mm.
He, in fact, was subservient, in a sense, to the children of Abraham.
Yeah.
Because, of course, he was one of Esau's. And, you know, so you can see the whole...
Absolutely. And interestingly, just on that end as well, is verse 17 talked about that people became Jews. We're going to see that with the Feast of Purim in the next class. I've gone over time. I'm really sorry. I wanted to just finish with the punchline, if I can. The great reversal. Have a look at some of the great reversals. So Mordecai here leaves on the king's horse now. He goes with the king's robes. Mordecai had wanted them himself. So I can probably hand these around later on, I can send these around later on if we need to. Chapter 3, verse 10. Chapter 3, verse 10. The king gives Haman his ring. Chapter 8, verse 2. The king gives Mordecai the ring. Chapter 3, verse 12. Haman summons the king's scribes. In chapter 8, verse 9, Mordecai summons the king's scribes. Chapter 3, verse 12, letters written and sealed with the ring. Chapter 8, verse 10, same thing, different edict. Chapter 3, verse 13, the Jews were to be killed on one day. Chapter 8, verse 11, the Jews can kill their enemies in one day. Chapter 3, verse 14, Haman's decree as public law. And in chapter 8, verse 13, Mordecai's decree as public law. Chapter 3, verse 15, couriers sent out in haste. And again in chapter 8, verse 14, different edict. Chapter 3, verse 15, the city of Susa bewildered. And in chapter 8, verse 15, the city rejoices. Chapter 4, verse 1, Mordecai wears sackcloth and ashes. In chapter 8, verse 15, he wears royal robes. Chapter 4, verse 1, he goes through the city crying. In chapter 6, verse 11, he's led through the city in honour. chapter 5, verse 14, Zeresh advises Mordecai's death. In chapter 6, verse 13, Zeresh predicts Haman's ruin. Chapter 4, verse 3, the Jews mourned throughout the empire. And chapter 8, verse 16, Jews celebrated throughout the empire. This is what God does for his people. And this is the theme throughout the entirety of Scripture, isn't it? That he reverses the order of things. And in a way, that comes back to my opening remarks. Because the more I learn of God and the more I learn of the choices of behaviour, the people he met with, the miracles he performed, that Jesus was the antithesis of a rabbi. It made no logical sense to have this man as the Son of God. And yet, in that exact fashion is why God chose him. Because he was nothing to look upon. He was not there to big note himself. He was not of great office. He was just a humble man who was loyal to his edict.